It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there, this is Annabelle. Let's see, I think someone has to turn down their laptop because we can hear the show. Okay, so thanks for joining. Hey guys. We're having feedback problems.
This is Annabelle.
Let's see, I think someone has to turn down their laptop. Okay, so thanks for joining. Okay, sorry, we're having technical problems. We're having feedback problems.
This is Annabelle.
Hey there. Sorry about this. We're having some technical problems. This is Annabelle. Let's see. Whoever, Eric or Jessica, if you guys are going to join me, you have to turn off your laptop. Okay. Let's see. Eric, are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hey there. Sorry about this. We're having some technical problems.
We're still having problems.
Annabelle.
Let's see. Eric, can you take over for a little bit?
Yeah, can you try hanging up and calling back in, and I'll take over.
Let's see. Eric, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me? You can't hear me, Annabelle? You can't hear me? Take over.
Eric, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. There's something wrong though. I'm gonna hang up. Can you host the show? I'm gonna hang up, okay?
Okay. Okay. You can't hear me? There is some crazy stuff going on right now with voices flying around. It sounds normal to me. We are gonna be talking about the future of the Occupy movement on this show. Our guests include Stefan Saeed from Occupy Wall Street and Rouge Al-Wazir from Occupy DC. Hosting the show will be Annabelle Park as soon as she figures out what's going on with these crazy sounds. And Jessica, are you there? Let me see. Hold on one second. I didn't expect to be hosting this show, so let me see here. Wow, crazy. I don't even know if anybody can hear me right now. Well, I'm going to assume Jessica can hear me. Jessica, can you hear me? Jessica, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, even like the control panel is going crazy right now. But I think we're on the air. and this is what happens when ordinary folks try to do the things that only the 1% media are supposed to do. And we're catching up technologically. Jessica, remind me of your last name. I'm sorry.
It's English.
Okay, right, Jessica English from Minnesota. She was one of our speakers at the rally we had at the United States Capitol on October 29th. And she was kind of one of the most beloved speakers because her words really spoke to a lot of people. What did you do? You did a bake sale to get enough money to come to the rally from Minnesota?
Well, thank you for that, Eric. I appreciate it. I actually made Citizens United soup. I had a fundraiser. It had three tiers. I also cleaned bathrooms and wrote poetry.
Wow.
And I have amazing friends who all contributed to my being able to attend the rally.
That's amazing. Yeah, and your speech really did touch a lot of people. I know I was one of the people that got to hug you afterwards. What a crazy cold day that was. I think that we have Stefan with us. Is that you in the 347 area code, Stefan?
Yes, that's it's me.
Hey, how's it going? Well, you're talking to... Oh, yeah, how you doing?
I'm well.
Good, good. So good. Annabelle's trying to figure out what's wrong with her phone right now, so
okay.
I'm emergency hosting. Are you back, Annabelle?
I am back, yeah. Sorry about this. I think it was because I was using Skype to call in before, but I'm here. Hey, everybody. Thanks.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, Skype and speakerphone, no go.
Yeah, my gosh. Okay. Now I know. Okay. Eric?
Happy Super Sunday.
Yeah, happy Super Sunday. So, yeah, it's a bit crazy for me to do this show on Super Sunday, but I didn't want to cancel the show, and I've been really dying to talk to you, Stefan. So here we go. Jessica is going to – she's very interested in your work, Stefan, and she has tons of questions for you. And I'm gonna start by asking Jessica to ask you the first question.
Great. Well, thanks, Annabelle. Thank you for this opportunity to interview somebody who's been so active. I guess first question for you, Stefan, how did you get involved in what was the first thing that you did or the first moment where you realized that you were going to get involved in the movement?
In which?
In the first.
Hello?
Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. You broke up. The first step in which I got involved in what?
In a movement where you realized that you wanted to get involved in a movement for social justice.
Generally.
Yeah, generally.
Gosh.
Not just Occupy.
I kind of wonder. I wonder. I grew up, sort of prone to activism and taking a stand. Neither left nor right. I never saw it as being that way. I saw it much more as just as a humanitarian outlook that I was raised with, you know. And but I'd say that really, truly, global justice activism that became the focus of all my work. I guess by the time it had all clarified, and I moved to New York both to be a singer and kind of an organizer. In the mid-late 90s. And that was just because I think I was really catalyzed by the first Iraq war. I mean, I'm Iraqi-American, right? But I'm a totally, like, all-American Virginian Southern boy. I have a pretty heavy accent if I want to turn it on. But I was raised in a household that was really global, you know? My mother was Austrian and Catholic, but with some Jewish Holocaust victims in the family. And then my father was Iraqi and Sunni Muslim and then I was raised by a Jesuit priest who had left the order. So I had like every religion in our house, practically all the major monotheistic religions, and had to grapple
wow.
with all the competing realities. And so my outlook was always very divisive, almost stridently so, because my own identity kind of crossed all these left and rights and conservatives and liberals and, you know, Muslims and Christians and Jews. And so that I think just propelled me since a young age almost to, and as a member, I think, of the global generation, knowing that or feeling that there had to be this great movement that I think humankind has always dreamt of people really treating each other as equals in order to create that kind of dignity that we all know or have inherently or should have and that we need to create the change we know is necessary. So that was really it. I mean, my whole career has been about it. I've written all my songs have basically been about trying to build that movement. So what can I say?
Mm-hmm.
I you know. My first real kind of break in or through, I guess, was in organizing in New York City and getting involved in police brutality issues. And because my first song was a song that broke out about Abner Louima, who was a Haitian immigrant that you guys might remember was kind of the biggest.
I remember. Definitely.
And so that threw me into the middle of that. And although also that, I saw that and then subsequently the Amadou Diallo incident, which I was also very much involved in the media about. I saw those as very much having to do with the rush of modern global society as, and what it was doing to all of us, and not what it was, and not as a left or right or a police against us issue as much as it was, oh my God, look what's happening to our entire society, such that, you know, police who were trying to protect us are so spun out that they would see a guy in his doorway reaching for a cell phone and shoot him. And just, it was just an indication of how much fear there was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is Annabelle. I was wondering more specifically about, you know, how song is different from other forms of protest. How music, you think, the power of music as opposed to other forms of protest.
I mean, one thing about music that's so beautiful is that it music has a dynamic to it that, you know, the sound that can engage people without even having to be dealing with politics in any kind of way. It can unite people that just like a melody. And we know that through history. So it can help unite people in a purely sort of in a spatial way, right? And it goes out physically, actually. You know, it's waves. They transcend space. It's period. So it adds into just a humanizing element that's really, really powerful.
Yeah.
However, it has its limitations too, you know, especially in our day and age where I think we're confronted with having to create a new paradigm, a new way of living with each other, not just in the United States, but globally. Mm-hmm. And knowing that, hey, well, the music industry is part of the old paradigm. So it's not enough to just sing a great song about needing to change the world anymore, especially when we have the tools to distribute songs in such a way today that could be emblematic or modeling a new, more egalitarian kind of system, as opposed to coming to you through, you know, here's my protest song coming to you through Sony BMG, which is as corrupt as Wall Street has been, has brought us all kinds of basically the most pornographic stuff you've heard in your lifetime on the radio and spent billions of dollars on promoting it while they're not letting us hear songs about unity and peace. Sounds a little bit familiar, right? Sounds kind of like... anyway. I'm hearing an echo, so I don't know where that's coming from.
I heard a bit of an echo there, too. I have a question about the technology and how it's affected our generation. And I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of talk about the technology really connecting all of us, and we've seen it connecting all of us through all of the different movements that have happened with the Arab Spring. What role do you feel the technology has, and is it a significant medium as a lot of people are hoping that it's going to be in bringing us all together?
That's for me,
yes.
That question. I think that it's obviously, I mean, there's no doubt and I think it's, we all know what an impact it's had from an organizing standpoint. To this point, I think it largely has been informational and organizing. So I think that it's very young. I think it's nascent, the era of online organizing, though what it's done has been massive so far. I think that the future of it hopefully is going to be that it actually does enable new models to new, like, sustainable social business models to truly come forth. And as an example, like with music, I I've been thinking about this a lot since last night, since the last piece I just published that you guys helped distribute on the Coffee Party site. Now I've turned my sights more onto something very close to my whole life's work and being music, over the frustration to see how many journalists in music are like, oh, but, you know, where's the songs of the Occupy Wall Street movement or the this or the, completely blind to the fact that, wow, you know, well, all these great songs that helped build the Arab Spring that got spread on the internet, like, you're not hearing any of them on the radio here in America, in case you didn't notice. And you're not actually really hearing them on any radio. And to get with our technology that we have now to the point that we're actually distributing that to mass audiences through our own distribution mechanism, which is possible, and distributing songs by people and writings by people, let's say in a modern, I always think of the modern day equivalent of what would have been the printing press of the Indian independence movement, where every movement has realized that they had to have their own distribution mechanisms for information.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we could really have that. And I set up a site this over the last year called different.org and used my new album to launch it, which would be exactly that, to work with all kinds of social organizations, social change organizations worldwide, to distribute the music that would help mm-hmm. actually build that movement through them, right? I mean,
mm-hmm. yeah.
As opposed to, like, so that we could actually fund and build the community and create networks, nodes for to build this network to create this movement. That's it's really doable today. And I think that that's the next step, but I don't think we've gotten there yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the coffee party world, we call it making the truth go viral. We're definitely engaged in trying to create a system in which people take responsibility for actually distributing new information and the truth. So we're definitely, it's a human network. I mean, definitely is. I mean, we've got to get people to take responsibility for that, right?
Yeah, Annabelle, I just wanted to know if you can hear the interference right now. If you, why don't you try muting yourself for a second? I'm going to ask Stefan a question. Or maybe it's not coming from you. Okay. Hey, Stefan, you know, what's really going on, and I think that your essay captured it, is we're seeing that the Occupy movement is being forced to transition into something else. I think that the way that law enforcement is being utilized to apply pressure to the camps, I recognized the shift in mood. I documented the very first day of Occupy DC, and I also went to many other camps around the country, Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, Wall Street, of course. And I saw the mood shift as it became clear that they were... Annabelle, maybe you could mute whatever it is that's kind of loudly breathing. But I saw that mood shift from one of just this ebulliency and hope that they could really change the conversation and change the world to really feeling as if they were under siege. And it's when you start to use force and you make it clear that the power apparatus is going to use force to stop you from protesting or from exercising your right to assemble, that people begin to, well, there's two things that happen. Those who decide to stay are the ones who are more comfortable with that level of conflict and that level of risk. And the ones that you lose, the ones who decide to leave, are some of the ones who had the best opportunity to be effective leaders and thinkers. And so I wanted you to kind of jump to what you're trying to say in your essay from the other day about what the future of the movement needs to be.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I just came from, I think it was the first Occupy community brunch today downtown, or one of them, but it's definitely the first one in a new space. And this conversation actually started to get its way even in, you know, really into that meeting or group kind of meeting today. My main thought, as I made clear in that article, the, you know, post-Oakland nonviolence and the future of Occupy article, was just the fact that we need to, like all movements, movements in general begin often through the expression of rage at the very beginning, some kind of actions. And they're primarily oppositional by necessity. And they always have to then transition, if they even make it that far, beyond that oppositional phase, that rage phase, into one in which they ascertain and define themselves by what they stand for. And that's when they make the shift into something that's positive and universal, something that inherently wins the PR battle. We've seen this with all movements. I mean, that lasts a long time. And they do that. They have to do that because that's how they, one, can inspire hope. And if you're familiar with, like, Elias Canetti's famous book, Crowds and Power, the psychology of crowds and of movements in general is that they have to be able to expand. And the only thing that is expansive to the maximum degree is a positive idea that can engage an unlimited amount of imagination. So without that, there's a movement is almost doomed to fail ultimately, because there isn't enough room for it to continue to grow and to engage everybody's minds and hearts. And you start running into, both on the grand scale of organizing and actions, a lack of positivity that keeps the public engaged. But you also deal with, because of the lack of a positive vision, something that's inherently necessary for, even on the organizational level, in the little subcommittee group meetings where people get in arguments. You don't have something strong enough to keep people together. You start seeing ego battles and infighting take over much more easily. That destroys and rots a movement from the inside out when you don't have something that everybody can agree on, right? Mm-hmm. If there isn't a firm base or a foundation and a commonality, despite everybody's autonomous differences and the diversity of tactics that people want to use, nonviolent or violent, whatever it is, those can all be included when everybody's at least agreed to a main overarching commonality. When you don't have it, things start to splinter and can't be sewn back together. And that's what I'm seeing as the biggest hurdle. But I don't see that as a hurdle for the Occupy movement alone. I see that as inherently a hurdle for all of our movements, be it the Tea Party, Coffee Party, for no party, all parties, for the Arab Spring, the Occupy movement. I mean, I think it's for the humankind in general. I think we all know, if we're Nick Kristof writing in the New York Times, or, an anarchist kid that just, quit high school and is down at, that was down at the community brunch today. And that's that, wow, we know that actually something's very systematically deeply wrong. So what is the vision,
Yeah. I mean, the way I think I have put it in the past is if the movement is about just shifting power as opposed to value, then it starts to, straying itself from all the eternal power struggles. I think that's also what you're saying as well. I have a caller from 410 number. Stefan, are you ready to take some calls?
Yeah, I'm happy to take calls. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Okay. 410 number. Do you have a question or comment for Stefan?
I just have a comment. This is Matthew Monk. Hi, Annabelle. I spoke at the Citizens Intervention back in October.
She probably muted herself, Matthew, because she's got a really strange sound coming out of her phone, and we don't know what the source of it is. But, yeah, please go ahead. What's your question or comment?
Okay, yes, I'm so sorry. I was really fascinated by this conversation that was going on a couple minutes ago, and I think it's very vital that these community organizing groups and the Occupy movement, the Coffee Party, and all of these organizations, which are basically organizing to create fundamental change, and rightfully so, in this country and around the world, it's important that they need to come together and have a unified voice. I've been involved with the organizing community a little bit, and I'm becoming more and more involved. But the one thing that I don't see is that there is and it seems to be changing, but we need to keep pushing for this change, is that there is not a sense of unity between all of these different organizations. They respect each other. They work with each other on a local level. But on the national level and on the international level, I don't see that there's a grand level of cooperation other than, speaking at the same event. And I think that has got to be one of the primary goals of this movement. of the Occupy movement and of the organizing movement is that we need to bring these different organizations that are part of that movement closer together. My whole thing is that, you know, when I studied the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Movement had many different organizations involved with it, and it had to, because with those different organizations, with different groups having a different stake, or maybe the same stake, but different groups of people involved in the movement, it was able to validate the movement, because people could say, wow, you know, if there are four or five different organizations that are really pushing for this, this must be something we need, and it must be a real issue. And I think that's what we need to do today. We need
Stefan, what do you think?
I put myself on mute in between, but I agree. I mean, I think that's in many ways my point of the article. At the same time, I think that then to get beyond just the superficial recognition of that very important step and the necessity of a unifying vision, of course, we're never going to get, and just like in the civil rights movement, all of these groups that combine behind at least, let's say, one or two major moral principles are not going to, and they don't need to combine on everything. Civil rights movement is, you know, Indian independence movement, whatever. They're all examples. Nobody was ever all together on everything. They didn't have to say we are, but the movement becomes implicit when there is a unifying vision, and I think we've already got it. I mean, how it's going to be spelled out and what kind of proposals are put forth, but we've got years, hopefully, to develop it, because it is going to take years to create a more equitable global economic system. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is, I think, pretty much across the board, even from conservatives to liberals and everybody without and in between, there's definitely a growing global consensus that that's necessary for international security at this point, as well as for environmental sustainability. But that doesn't mean that we're going to have, you know, that we're not going to have some groups who are going to be very, very militaristic about it, and some who are extremely nonviolent. That's fine.
You know, I wanted to expand on your analogy to the civil rights movement and the Vietnam era. You know, some things have changed since then in terms of the way that media is disseminated. In the days of the civil rights movement, I'm sorry, I just still hear those strange noises, but in those days, there were really only three networks. And so when it came to pass that power began to express itself on the bodies of the protesters in order to apply the kind of pressure that we were talking about earlier that's happening to the Occupy movement to create that dissent, to intimidate people into not participating. I'm talking about the fire hoses that Bull Connor used in Montgomery, Alabama, or the dogs. What happened was that images from that brutality spread throughout the country and began to shape public opinion and inspire courage when the intention was to inspire fear. And by the same token, with the anti-war movement, images from Kent State of this young woman peering down at her dead classmate, and this picture, this Pulitzer Prize winning picture, is on every newspaper around the United States, and people began to ask themselves, you know, is this war really just if they have to shoot our children to enforce compliance? So today, you know, I think we can be thankful, and I don't think it would have been possible to have a global democracy movement if there hadn't been a huge democratization of media so that many people can share in the narrative, and that images like, you know, what happened, what happened with the mace or whatever that stuff is that was sprayed on those kids, those images, Riverside, was it? UC Riverside? That those kinds of images do spread, but I think that the media has a very different attitude toward what they want to share, what they want to disseminate, and particularly toward this movement. I think that a media that is more focused on commercial exploitation, on advertising dollars, and of course on preserving the sort of corporate oligarchy that we have, isn't necessarily going to share those images, because we have had images like those, the soldier who was hit with the in Oakland. What was his name? Scott.
Scott Olson.
Yeah, Scott Olson. Like those images, I think in another era would have been on every newspaper and every TV show, but in this case it was only kind of shared through social media, and it sort of speaks to the responsibility that those people who are involved in social media have to make up for the fact that we really no longer have those kinds of journalistic networks that are going to cover these stories as news rather than simply as filler to put in between their commercials.
Yeah. We have another caller, by the way. 908 number.
I'm here. Sorry, I had it on mute. How you doing, Stephen? Well, looking at today's topic about being a super citizen, a couple of things that I've figured into how information gets disseminated. Generally speaking, people will like to watch and look at the natural order of television, and a lot of people will watch their faction or their passion in terms of which side that they're taking, whether it's Tea Party and they're listening to Fox News, or if they're a progressive and they're watching MSNBC. And what I've come to the conclusion of is that there's all these other little organizations, Coffee Party being one of the bigger ones of those, that they'll get every now and then little blips on the air about how, different things that we're a part of. And I'm a manufacturer, okay, and one of the things that I've done is figured that guerrilla marketing makes life a little bit easier for me, because it's less expensive and I can get my word out to many different people, even if it's not a traditional method. But to really get the big bulk of people to do something, I advertise on an infomercial, and I've gotten more orders from that than anything else. So what I've started seeing here is that Occupy gets some airtime, but it's free airtime. The hard thing, I think, for us, if we want to really turn into super citizens to get our word out, is to figure out how we can get onto all of these other larger television mediums that would give us more of an ability to espouse the views that need to be espoused. And I don't know how often, Annabelle, you travel, or how often you get out onto the scene, at least from either the media standpoint or from doing all the guerrilla marketing that you do for Coffee Party. But I would definitely love to see more people getting onto Rachel Maddow coming from a Coffee Party perspective, or to get onto even going the route of Current TV, where you go in on Keith Olbermann, because at least that's a lead in to getting on television. Because the more we can do that, and you are amazing at getting rallies set up, but I'm a big believer that Tea Party has such an influence because the people, the corporatists that decided early on that they were going to get ahead of the game here, that they were going to get behind a bunch of very non-educated, very passionate, somewhat discriminatory people against the president that they didn't believe should be where he's at, and on the far right fringe think that he's a Kenyan. So what can we do as super citizens to help you get to that point?
Annabelle?
Yeah.
I think that's for you.
Yes, that's to her. I'm sorry.
I try to answer that. I would say that part of the paradigm of the mainstream media is they like conflict. And This is why I think, to me, the biggest reason why the Tea Party has been successful is that they created conflict. And I think Occupy as well, by having those confrontations with the police, help them get on the radar of mainstream news. And if you're like Coffee Party, really advancing notion of responsible civic engagement and civility, it does fit within that paradigm. And so it's more difficult to get on the radar. I mean, initially when we started, we got a lot of media attention because we positioned us as the anti-Tea Party. And we try to explain at every opportunity that we're not about being against the Tea Party, but we are for trying to get people to be informed and engaged as fellow Americans, as opposed to assuming this division, right? And so that division, that polarization, is kind of the model, the structure for how we understand politics. I guess for some people, that's how people understand life. It's always competitive. It's always about being against. And this is why I like Stefan is because he's also saying that, you know, we have to be for things. We can't just be stuck being against things. That this is not a football game. No knock on the Super Bowl, but this is not a football game. It's about somebody winning and somebody losing. But it's about the choices that we want to make about how we want to govern ourselves and what kind of relationships we want to have with the rest of humanity. And those questions are much more open-ended. And it requires a lot of imagination and creativity, and it's not about just, you know, winning a game. It's not a game. So we're trying to change the paradigm here. So, you know, if we just went for trying to get as much media as possible, we wouldn't have taken this path. You see what I mean?
I completely agree with that statement. Yeah. But if you look at the example that Gandhi, you know, put forth in terms of passive, being a passive protester, which, you know, he walked to go get salt, and everybody knows the stories of how Gandhi did it. But his initial thing was always to institute and instigate the conflict from the other side. He would walk up when he tore up his voter balloting. He would walk up to them and put it in the trash, and they would beat on him. And not only would they beat on him, but they'd beat on his followers the same way. So there is an air of violence, but it's only from the perspective of passive resistance to the conflict in front of them that they were able to get out such a movement. And this is what Occupy absolutely, that space of Occupy fulfills. But we're missing the one side of this that they had back then. They didn't have television back then, so, you know, word traveled. But if we don't have that video of somebody getting hit with shrapnel from a tear gas canister, and that we keep on that and keep pushing that back out into the forefront to where American citizens themselves see this as, this is an American society where the police are attacking. It's a war on the people of the United States. That's basically how I started seeing this. If you're allowing the police, who are supposed to keep, not just in the name of keeping the peace, creating a violent act and not holding them to that, which in New York City we all know where it's going. That woman who got shot in the face for doing nothing more but standing there, that cop has yet to be brought up on charges. The reality here is if we don't stand up for that as people and continue to put it on big media, that's the way I started seeing this, then it's going to fall by the wayside because people only remember what they see in front of them on a consistent basis.
Yes, that's true. But, the fact is, this is, I guess, where I'm a little bit different maybe from the original impetus for Occupy as well. I mean, where I stand is I feel like we do have a democracy. You know, right now, you know, Gandhi helped usher in a modern democracy in India. And you don't have those acts of civil disobedience as an everyday part of the process in India right now. Right, because they have a democracy. There are things that they can be improved, and there are movements, like recently, anti-corruption movement, to fix problems within their democracy. But that's what they have, and I think where we fall short is that we don't fully participate in our democracy right now as it's set up. You know, so I feel invested in trying to get, before, you know, we start engaging just thinking that civil disobedience is the only tactic, I want to see if we can get better voter turnout. I mean, it's not mutually exclusive. You have to have one or the other. But
yeah.
I don't think we just focus on having confrontations with the police to get in the media to change our society. We have to get people informed, and we've got to get them to vote. Because to me, a lot of what's going on is brainwashing. You know,
yeah.
The reason why people... Why money buys elections right now is because they buy ads that lie to people. and that influences how people vote. If we can train people to turn off those ads and go somewhere else to get informed, we would have a different outcome. You know, if we had, this is what my new mantra, if we had 99% voter turnout of the 99% in every election, we would have much more power as a people.
I always look at it like this. Australia should have, well, we should follow the same suit as Australia and England. You can't put anything out until a month before the election or 3 months before the election, depending upon which country. But they have 99% voter turnout regardless of anybody. It's a legal necessity for you to actually vote. And it's the same way that we have to serve jury duty here. I'm a big believer that compulsory voting is a necessity so that you can have a stand-up government and not just 36% of the electorate deciding for the other 64%. That's just, it's unheard of in any kind of democracy.
Exactly. So I feel there's so much that we can do that isn't just about dismantling our system, you know, and it's about people stepping up their participation, right?
Yeah.
And so, but I want to go back to a question for Stefan, and I was going to bring Jessica back for a second, is, since you wrote this essay, Stefan, like, what's been the response from the occupiers? Do they feel like it's a kind of a direct criticism of their tactics?
You know, I've only gotten positive feedback. I expected to get positive feedback, and I expected to get some negative feedback. But to this point, I actually have only gotten positive feedback. Now, I have jokes with people that I don't know if that's also because people that don't like it are just busy, you know, cursing my name behind their backs, my back or something like that, and they're not making it public. But to this point, it's pretty much actually been all positive, which I think was a real – it's almost a surprise to me. But then again, I think maybe it's a sign of it's a really good sign, and I would hope it's a real sign of the resilience of the movement, because that's what it's going to take for it to be sustainable right now and for it actually to undergo a transformation into something that now is sustainable and can grow much bigger than it is now. It's been pretty much 100% positive, and I'm surprised. I also, you know, when I wrote it, I wrote it obviously out of a frustration seeing the discussion about nonviolent civil disobedience, basically just kind of saying, oh, well, we need to be nonviolent as though that was the end all of it, without any real critical conversation about what real strategic nonviolent civil disobedience is. And you guys were just speaking about it to a certain degree, and it does have to have a real weight that's balanced between between the very necessary oppositional actions. I mean, yes, you have to oppose what's wrong. But the most important thing, though, is that while you do that, the message within it, and by the nature of the craftily strategized actions, contain more powerfully a positive statement about an inalienable claim to an inalienable right. When Gandhi did something like rip a ballot or goes to get salt, you know, from a mine that's been nationalized by a country outside of India, it was confrontational and soldiers are coming there. Still, the first thing people are thinking is like, oh my God, look, there's a conflict. No, it actually wasn't. The first thing was like, these people are claiming something that is their right by nature. And that's why they're doing this action. Not, oh, they're just occupying, and what's their message? That's not good enough. And I think in the Occupy has had some amazing actions. It's a question of, you know, of learning and growing, and this happens in all movements, and being able to see where we have to go. But I've also started to realize or get a better grasp on the fact that all of these things are not in competition with each other. They're all, in the, whether or not, let's say, how can I best put it? The things that we've been discussing today are really from whether it be how much is messaging, how much is the type of the nonviolent action, or should it be about voter turnout? Should it be the best actions are ones that combine all of them in one. That's when they become so that they're not actually separated at all. And for example, that the example of ripping the ballot is an amazing thing. It actually is doing something about voter turnout, using it to catalyze a very extreme statement that is based in an inalienable right and a complaint that one is not, it is not being recognized, and it is resulting or being manifest in a conflictual action that's getting the publicity. And that's just plain old experience, smart strategizing. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't like Gandhi lucked out by coming up with an idea like that. That's kind of 101 for intelligent movement organizing. We're not going to assume that everybody in any movement, like in the civil rights movement or any of them, actually has studied or has spent years, you know, working on these kinds of ideas. How old was Gandhi by the time these actions took place, right? He'd already been in the Red Cross and in the war in South Africa, right? This guy was older than I am at this point, or any of us probably on the call. So we've got to have some patience with each other at the same time that we have to realize that we can formulate ideas, and the most powerful ones that we can formulate are going to be ones that combine all of these elements and not see them as competing elements, but as elements of what should be the best strategies we can create.
I think that's really fabulous, and it really brings me to some of the lyrics that this was in a song, United for a Global Spring. It's, we have to be the change every generation before dreamt of but never achieved. We have to reach across borders and nonviolently take a stand for that dream to make it a reality. And when I read that, you know, and after listening to you speaking just now, I think about the locally, with just each other and with one.
Right, I think, Jessica, there's some sound problems.
You're breaking up a little.
Yeah. Can you call in from another phone, maybe? Eric Tyler, I want to get you back. Are you there, Eric? Eric, are you there? Okay. Well, let's see. While we're waiting for Eric and Jessica to come on, I want to say that I feel like, you know, you and I are so similar in how we're approaching this, because I feel like I'm more of an artist, filmmaker than a politician. And sometimes I wonder if I say things that to just try to get people to change at an internal level. Like I keep talking about people assuming responsibility and seeing themselves as agents of change as opposed to people who are subject or possibly receiving information and passively participating in our democracy. And so much of this is psychological to me. And so I'm just wondering, like, you know, how we turn that switch on. How do we get people to assume themselves and to really recognize not their participation? Like, we're just not going to get there. I mean, that's kind of where I am.
I think that the what it comes to me to my mind immediately when you put it that way and in such a right, you know, a smart question is that we need to have people need workable models for an alternative to get involved in. That's what they have to have. I mean, it's already been put out there. I mean, the idea that we need change. And at this point, it also has to do with sort of attention span. It's just like what I was saying about crowds and power, Elias Canetti, and having to have an idea that's big enough. It's also not enough to just have that idea. That idea has to grow into workable, sustainable models. Because as soon as we have, because that's where we see progress. And when people have that, then it also, well, you're building something. You're really, you're not just creating a network of people that have share ideals, but who are then doing something. And just as an example, because I can only give it as an example, but when I was had envisioned that with my new album, I had envisioned, hey, well, I don't want to release another song or MP3 or online video for a social cause alone. I'd already done that. Sure, it's become very pop to do it, and in the collapse of the music industry, all kinds of artists who've never been political before, even their major record labels are trying to envision do-good campaigns for purely, actually, maybe there's some altruism, but it's also because they don't know how else to market people anymore, and they know that they can maybe have some success. But at this point, I realize that's not enough, because we actually need a paradigm shift, and kids all over the world who know that and know it in their hearts, regardless of their degree of education, because it's just common sense, they want that. They need examples for hope. And if they could have examples that they could get engaged in, they would. And I thought, how could I do something? I want to release an album that's not going to just be another one-off for social change, but to build actually a network by which lots of artists and lots of youth could have their work for a better world distributed, to eventually turn into a whole new model in which, like in a Grameen Bank-styled music industry, online music industry model or something, funds would be being shared or to raise or to from the sale of the songs, for example, from all these artists worldwide to support initiatives for social change all over the world, whereby in total we had actually a new business model that was much more egalitarian, not going into this same type of repetitive, big profit-first marketing record label machine. So we've actually create an alternative that embodies the change that we want to see. And I'm only offering that as one example from my field, my specific field that I spent my most energy on in my career, aside from writing and stuff. But I think that that's a real key for all of our businesses. And if we could unite this whole social venture kind of thinking about sustainable businesses with this idea of creating this more equal world and unite, as the caller in was saying, use that as a way that we could actually unite these many social change organizations and movements like Coffee Party or whatever it might be, Avaaz or, you know, and even institutions, be it the UNESCO or whatever, then we really could reach hundreds of millions of people with a whole new way of doing it. It's possible, and the world is ready for it. And that's what I see. That's my response.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Let's see. 908, do you want to respond to what the founder said?
It's almost like I was just about to put into the chat here that as true capitalism is kind of interesting for me, because I look at the way that our system is now, with the unfair weight of the representation being on the top and the lower part of us, which is the many more of us, having very limited representation because of money. It's almost, it goes back to the fact that capitalism in its own accord ends up killing itself off, because if you look at capitalism in an economy like a garden, if you allow one bush to grow so large that it takes up all the resources, all the rest of the garden dies. Only that one bush is allowed to stay. And what we end up coming back to is that if that becomes a dictatorship over the course of time. Democracy leads us there. And the one thing that I hate to even bring up, because this is another discussion of its own, but democracy ends up leading us there, because the control of the majority ends up outweighing the actual sense of the minority, or even the ability for the minority to speak. The minority control the majority, then it's much worse, and everything slips upside down. But if you are able to split that bush up into smaller and smaller pieces, then the rest of the garden has a chance to flourish. And I'm not saying that people who have made so much money in this country should get rid of all of their funds. I'm not saying that, because on a lot of levels we don't want a French Revolution. What I am saying is that the initial anti-monopoly, the initial antitrust laws didn't really take into account for capitalism to grow and then re-merge, as a lot of these banks did. So my suggestion here is, in terms of how we are represented, that we have to really focus our energies, absolutely, in organization, as Stefan said. Forgive me for calling you Stephen at the very beginning. I had no idea. But in respect to how we have to organize, we need to organize and get a mass movement together. So organizing the Occupy movements, for sure, and embracing them under a coffee party wing is probably not the worst of ideas. That's up to you for sure. But in respect to how you get that to grow, once you have that, the focus on a lot of levels should be that we don't want to destroy your wealth. What we want to do is to break you guys down into your own departments so those departments can absolutely compete with each other. This was proven in the 1920s because with Glass-Steagall implemented, you separated your savings banks and your investment banks. On a lot of levels, those you can look at them as departments. And if you can do that and you can grow those individually because they have their very niche markets, and the people who work for those niche markets are professionals and they know what they're doing in those niche markets. Now that we have investment banks that are party with these savings banks, then you open the floodgates, yes, for a lot of growth, but you're going to grow that bush too large when you have Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase Manhattan, all paired up with investment banks and able to grow beyond the means of control. Then you have the situation where the housing market died and what they're trying to do is eat up all the land out from underneath us. We have to break all of that up, and in order to do that, we absolutely have to embrace as many different smaller entities of these movements like Coffee Party and Occupy Wall Street and fuse them together on a lot of levels, from my opinion at least, in order to... Mm-hmm.
I see Occupy Coffee Party being part of one larger, broader movement towards social change, and so I don't feel like it's like we have to make them fuse with them. I feel like there's so much overlap in spirit and actually people that we're all part of one movement. I think the question is, it's like, how are we going to get from point A to point B? Because there's a lot of agreement about point B, what that destination should be. But I think there's a lot of disagreement about how to get there. What's the roadmap we're going to follow? And so this is one of the reasons, like, I've been talking to Stefan, is, you know, I think it's very important to get people to imagine the alternative. What is the create? Imagine and create that alternative, but do what you're suggesting at the same time, which is we have to understand that we're in a fragile ecosystem, and that we do have to resist and stop the things that are poisoning and destroying and, in some cases, killing us. You know, so I think we have to do both. We have to be protective and preserve, and at the same time create this alternative and get people to imagine that these big changes are possible, right? And so... So I think, you know, there's a disagreement just about, you know, tactics, but I really believe that we all know in our hearts, in our souls, in our DNA, that in order for us to survive, we have to have changes. We can't. What we have right now is not sustainable. So, anyway, that's sort of the basic response. So, I agree with Stefan, but I also believe that we have to figure out how to create points of resistance and demand, political power, so that we do implement things like Glass-Steagall and we do figure out how to get rid of the influence of money in our politics and to have American people and people around the world feel like the government serves them and we don't serve our government. Things have just flipped around. It feels like right now we're serving our governments and our financial system, and it's not serving us. And, you know, I think like any relationship, it's about what we do and what we think, as well as what actually has to change in the institutions, you know, if that makes sense. Stefan, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go pretty soon, but I've got about 10 more minutes before I have to leave. But
can you say more about the actual tactics? Like, what do you think works and what? So what is a positive? I think we get the vision, but what are some very powerful tactics to kind of get us from where we are right now to that sense of equality and harmony and dignity for all human beings? Like, how do we get there?
I mean, there's so many issues, so many problem areas right now, right? We're like, I think like on y'all's Facebook page, I was writing to somebody in response, just sort of like, you know, to even think of all the holes, you can't even think of all the holes that we have to put our fingers in the dike that's blowing because it's actually already completely burst. You know, there's thousands of issues. It's Glass-Steagall and Citizens United and, you know, and education and public school education and foreign policy, NDAA, SOPA, PIPA, you know, how many things do you go for? But I think across the board, while, yes, I don't think any of them can be powerful or empowered or properly contextualized, any actions on any of these domestically or internationally can be properly contextualized without the great vision, which has to be first and foremost. All of these individual actions, obviously you take them on a one-by-one case basis, but the overriding thing that always drives me is to think as you were even implying, and I think, Annabelle, and that is, I always think in terms of service. And I think that was very much also like in a Gandhian or a kind of perspective on nonviolence. If your action is based in service, that is doing a service that is good and doing it in a rebellious, you know, way, doing what's not being done but that should be done, for example, just picking it up and doing it despite the fact that the broken system's not doing it, becomes such an unbelievably, unstoppable or irrepressible statement. So I was speaking with somebody today about the May Day actions coming up that Occupy's working on, and the Board of Education actions that they've been doing or working on are something that have really meant a lot to me because, it's amazing to see 7, 9, 10-year-old children going, gosh, I don't have a teacher in my classroom and they're laying more teachers off, you know? Well, that's powerful. And I thought, well, I don't want to go out and just protest anymore. I want my protest to be that I'm going to go and teach children in elementary schools where we're not paying for teachers to be, you know, and make that my action in the same way that, on the Gandhian example, what did he say when he was like, well, do you oppose the war? Are you going to not go? And he's like, no, I'm not going to refuse to go to the war. I'm going to go and be in the Red Cross, and I'm going to take care of the people who are being killed. While, you know? So, yes, the protest is there, but at the same time, there's a very positive action, a dedication, a service. And I think that if we use that as a sort of a major kind of question that we ask of ourselves when we strategize what we're going to do about Citizens United or about NDAA or about fracking or whatever it is, if what we do serves at the same time as something that's helping the society simultaneously in the action, it's a really powerful question to ask that helps guide, I think, the most powerful actions. That's really a guiding thing for me. There has to be an inherent good beyond the protest.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, what's happening out there where you're like, that's it? That's a very powerful, important task. Are you
me?
Seeing something? Yeah, on the horizon right now.
I've seen a lot of things. I mean, although at the same time, I have to say that with our movements right now, they're all about getting engaged and getting in there. And like every time I see something that's not exciting me, I'm trying to keep myself from thinking, well, I'm burned out. I'm tired of dealing with like what I think are maybe not such great ideas, and which I'm sure happens to all of us. And to think, no, it's your choice. It's my choice to engage, because nobody's telling me not to engage, and to bring my voice to those too, and to try to work with that group, with groups of people to collectively come up with the best idea. So I'm struggling with that myself. You know, I think a lot of people are. It's been an exhausting year, especially. I mean, even for me. You know, it's my entire career has been geared toward building this global movement since before Seattle to the present. The last year, watching the Egyptian revolution, for example, run into problems when, from the very beginning at least, it was never envisioned as merely a national effort. The global consciousness amongst the youth starting that, and that I was in touch with, it was very intelligent and knew that it could not be the people that instigated that were aware that there had to be global systemic change in order for the preconditions that were creating the problems within Egypt to truly be sustainably solved, you know? What excites me the most is thinking out of the box, and it's thinking about doing really effective actions, like you're saying. We need to think about, and about domestic or international issues, but simultaneously trying to explode the confining visions of a lot of the movements that we're involved in to be what I think is necessary, and I think people really recognize deep down is necessary. I think if we can get conversations happening across the globe about building this global movement, it's going to take off like wildfire, and I think it's going to inform our perspective and create much more effective actions on the national and local level as a result of the sheer responsibility that people will be aware that they hold in their hands. As soon as it becomes globalized, people know. You know what I mean? They realize how big the dream is that we're going for. So there you go. That's what excites me.
Well, that's inspiring.
It's a long tirade, but that's...
I appreciate it, Stefan, and I appreciate all the work you're doing. It really is inspiring, and we're checking with you really soon. Thanks for joining us.
Well, you too. I mean, what an honor and a pleasure to, and thank you for sharing the piece that I wrote, and you know, it's just been great to have this exchange and to learn from it and be inspired. So,
enjoy your Sunday, rest of your Sunday, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, we'll do. Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, Stefan. Okay, actually, I have a couple of callers. I think one of them is Jessica calling back, but 832 and 651. So I'm going to go to 832 because you've been on hold for a while. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, Annabelle.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Hi. Who's this?
This is Pankage.
Hey there.
Hi. Yes, did you get my idea, for example, like about how to, like what you thought of it?
I basically know what it is, and I think I asked you to email the new board about it. I do like the idea. I think your idea is to get people to email and they call every day about public funding of elections.
Campaign, public financing of campaign and elections, and issues like term limits and... I mentioned to you eliminating pensions, because here is the reason why. One may think that it is not an effective strategy because you can only perceive few people doing it. But if there is a way that everybody to 300 million people do it, think about how effective that would be. In other words, you know what I call it? I actually have a new nickname for it, and I call it the pajama revolution.
I like that, Pankaj. I want to get some feedback from other callers on that. So, yeah, Pankaj has been talking about this for a while, of trying to get as many people as possible to make calls to Congress every single day and not let up and just be relentless. But let's see, I have 651 and 401 waiting as well. But feel free to share your thoughts on anything that any one of us has said, including Pankaj and Stefan or anyone. And Eric, I don't know if you're back yet. I thought maybe I lost you to football, but hope
no,
you're
no,
back.
No, I'm here.
Okay. Hi, 651.
Hey, this is Jessica calling back in. I hope I'm on a better connection now or that I have a better connection
better.
To you. Can you hear me? Okay. Yes. I was able to hear most of the conversation, though I did hang up for a little while at the end there. But I just think he's an excellent writer, and he's had so much experience with the movements and and so my big questions for him were regarding community building. I really liked what he was saying about being patient. And I think from my own experience in seeing what's happening here locally in Minnesota is that there's a lot of community building going around, going on within the movement here on the ground. And that takes time, people getting to know one another, people trusting each other to sharing of ideas and figuring out what are we going to do, what is our plan. And, I think his example of Gandhi and the people who followed him being willing to be beaten, they must have had a community behind that, because there are great ideas and there is out-of-the-box thinking and there is violence that can come into it and pass, peaceful, nonviolent actions that we can be part of. But there's also that community that's happening as well. And so my questions for him, I wish I could have gotten to ask, were what has he seen in his experience that has built those communities up, that worked?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think my guess is he would say that there are values, humanistic values, that would precede the political goals. I think
mm-hmm.
that's along the lines of what he would say, common vision. I mean, he's a real poet and a singer and artist, and I think he sees, he's driven by things like truth and beauty and justice, and there are communities of people, I think, that coalesce around seeing sort of the common vision for those things. But hang on a second, Jessica. I'm glad you have a guide. I'm going to keep you open. 401, and then I'm going to go back to camera 908. And feel free to jump in anytime, Eric. 401.
Hi, Annabelle. It's Linda. Hi, Annabelle. It's Linda. I actually didn't know. I have you in my back pocket because I'm doing a private duty case. So maybe, and I walk around and listen. So maybe I hit you. But I learned so much, and I was like, oh, I can't believe she's going to do it today on Super Bowl Sunday. But this is an awesome show. So you can mute me back out. I'm just listening out of one ear and walking around and working.
Thanks a lot, Linda, for being a regular. If you want to call in, don't forget to push 1 so that you're in queue to speak. Eric, what are your thoughts?
Well, so many. I think that the only place where I feel that we've been able to have real impact, or the most significant place, I think, with the coffee party, is in shifting the national narrative. I think that up until the last few years, it has been very much that the platforms for mass communication were controlled by a tiny elite, wealthy group of families and corporations. And those times when stories about ordinary people were, ordinary people organizing actually made the news, were limited to brief 15-second stories that there was a rally today. Or then with the Tea Party, of course, it was first orchestrated by a major news network, the Fox News Network, and then reported upon as if it was organic. And then, I don't think it was surprising to many that it ended up being a movement that worked in the favor of 1% agenda, because it was orchestrated and manipulated by 1% Media, and cast members were consumers of that media. And so all of the different things, I agree with you, Annabelle, that this really is one giant movement. And this talk of, well, we all need to learn how to work together and follow one leader. I mean, I heard that talk both before and after the gigantic changes that we've seen in 2011 with the Arab Spring and Wisconsin and, of course, Occupy. And I'm not sure if that's, I mean, I'm not sure if that's the key to get everybody to follow one tune. I think that the revolutionary breakthrough is the democratization of media, so that instead of there being one narrative that comes only from the ruling class, only from the 1%, and then we as consumers get to choose between different versions of that narrative, but don't get to participate and don't get to actually share information of our own. The fact that we now all can do that, that's the big shift. And I don't think we should lament that there are different tactics and different philosophies and there's different things going on. I think that that is what gives us a fighting chance. So I'm encouraged by the narrative shift. I think Occupy has been essential because they showed enough courage to put their bodies on the line, to risk violence from their government toward them, to get their message out. And that kind of courage has inspired people. And, of course, I'm saddened to see that the strategy has worked to use the police to basically create a new conflict. So instead of focusing on the conflict between plutocracy and a representative democracy, many of the protesters who are willing to remain are focused on the conflict between the police and the protesters. That's exactly what the 1% designed when they began to lean on the mayors and lean on law enforcement to create that conflict. So, it did backfire in some ways, and you saw that things got in the news to some degree, not the degree that it would have if the news was really the news, and the courage of the protesters inspired people. But now, I mean, I'm afraid to say that the young people who I've been interviewing from the beginning are really discouraged because the constant pressure, the constant conflict with the police is wearing down the people with the really good souls. Sometimes they're getting frightened away, and others who remain are not the ones who are really capable of leading an effective movement because they're the type of people who are so comfortable with conflict that they're blinded by it. I'm saddened by that, but I'm not worried in the sense of the global movement or the national movement within this country, because I think the narrative has already shifted. And just as the spark, let's just say it was Egypt, okay, even though there was Tunisia and Iran before that. Just as it doesn't really matter, I mean, it matters, of course, but it doesn't impact the United States and our democracy movement whether or not Egypt is successful in building a truly just democratic government. They could fail, they could succeed, but it wouldn't impact what happens here in America. By the same token, those early brave protesters, and whatever it is that we refer to as Occupy, whether or not they are able to maintain their nonviolent commitments, whether or not they're ever able to transition into a more direct engagement with our political process to actually have impact on the policies that they so object to, whether or not they do that, they've inspired millions of other people to get engaged, millions of other people to see the world in a different way, because now there are two narratives. There's the 1% narrative and there's the 99% narrative with all its complexity and all its cacophony and all the different zigs and zags and every which way. And that's what a democracy is supposed to look like. It's supposed to have many voices, and we're beginning the process of having a genuine conversation that isn't being dictated to us by some satellites and some radio networks and some TV networks that are owned by five or six really wealthy dudes.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could be as optimistic as you are, Eric, about this, because I mean, I agree that it's not, to me, a matter of trying to get everyone to be part of one movement in the sense that there's one leader and there's one hierarchy. I don't think that's going to work at all. But I do think we need a map that we're all using to work from. Because in order to get to our destination of real change and real justice and survival, you know, we have to work quickly. I don't think we can just allow the sort of, you know, our nature and just what you're describing. Like, I just don't know if we can rely on that to get to real changes so that people live.
Yeah, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the change is the arena, the rhetorical playing field that we are on, right? It's the imagination of the people that's changed. It's the field, since it's a football day. The field has changed. It's no longer tilted against us. We actually, maybe it's still tilted against us, but it's at an angle that we can move now. We have agency. So, yeah, what are the plays we're going to call? Are we going to go with a ground game? Are we going to do an aerial attack? How are we going to, what football plays are we going to call? Those are the questions. And now, I think compared to 2 years ago when you started the Coffee Party movement, Annabelle, people are listening. And it doesn't require something on a 1% news network to start a movement. It can start on the internet now because people's ears are open, their imagination is open. So I think you are one of those people. I think Lawrence Lessig is one of those people. I think David Cobb is one of those people who has a plan to quarterback this movement. The field wasn't there for us before. Now it is. And so we're going to see what happens when the right quarterback emerges. It has to be someone who has a plan and believes in that plan and understands how and why the whole ground has shifted beneath our feet and how to exploit that.
Yeah, no, I agree that the playground or the field has shifted, but at the same time, I guess I feel like in order, you know, looking at past movements, especially, say, the civil rights movement, suffrage movement, there was an enormous amount of discipline involved. And I think that we have to have a certain level of discipline and certain kind of infrastructure in order for us to win, because it's not enough to just get people to think differently or change the playing field. I think those are very important, and they're first steps. They're necessary steps, but they're not sufficient steps. We need that discipline. And so that's why I guess I'm still concerned. I don't feel like I think we're taking baby steps, and there's a just ton of work to be done. Okay, so we only have a few minutes left, and I did want to go back to Cameron, who's been on hold, and Jessica's still on the line, and we're going to start to wrap up soon. Okay,
yep.
Cameron.
Okay, so there's a lot of stuff I want to deal with what Eric just said, but I want to go back to the initial point, which was in terms of funding things, funding our elections on a public level, whereas these private donorships just should not work. I mean, Citizens United, at some point here, Congress is probably going to pass something, an amendment to the Constitution that makes it corporate personhood illegal, but that still doesn't fix the problem. The real way that we can fix this problem is that we make it illegal to just give to one person in our electorate system that is running for office. We have to make it a legal thing to that they have to give equal amounts to all by donating to an anonymous fund that is not only just governed by the people, because the people should be the only people who are electing people, if that makes some sense. But if corporations want to donate to find this an equal share that they are people in this world, that you allow it to only go to an anonymous fund. And that anonymous fund can be a derivative of federal, state, county, and local elections that can be pulled from based upon the amount that's in those funds. I understand how expensive it is to go on a national scene, but and that we have parties that are split, and there's a paradigm here where the parties themselves are, you know, basically fronting each other, and they're not flanking each other anymore. They're now fighting within each other because of the Citizens United on some levels. But if you take a good hard look at this situation that we have two heads on the same monster. And until we really draw this back and put two leashes on that monster And the only way I can see that is through making nationalizing our elections and nationalizing the funding of those elections. We're in this position where we can't really do much other than sit there and watch our voices get drowned out by the large megaphone of money. The other side that I figured out here was that if we get the FCC to make four channels, I mean, we already have C-SPAN 1, 2, 3, and 4. So why not make C-SPAN, especially for elections, federal, state, county, and municipal, that allow free advertising for all candidates that they want that have an equal share on that time, and allow corporate advertising for or against a candidate with the stipulation that they state who they're advertising for or against, but that they must do so. I'm a believer that people want to see what our candidates have to say about any given situation. I mean, how many times have we seen Mitt Romney flip-flop back and forth, Newt Gingrich lie to us, and to sit back and watch the Democrats sort of placate, but they're placating from a position of strength at the moment. So we really need to take a good hard look at this and push that button. We really should focus the spear, as they say, because the faster we can strike that spear into this animal, the better off we are.
Thank you. Jessica, any thoughts as we...
Yeah, I really liked what Eric was saying, and I think that the paradigm that we were in before allowed a lot of people to not, I don't want to say sit back, you know, when we had just a few one percenters using their megaphone for the news, it allowed people to be uninvolved, and that allowed them to work us harder, and the more we worked and worked and worked, the less involved we became. And so I think what we have now, what you've given us, is a realization that we can be involved and we can join in community and work together and do things like the last caller was talking about, it was Cameron, pushing that button, focusing the sphere, and sharing our ideas with each other. And I'm really inspired to see a lot of people doing that at my local level. They're gathering together and educating kids after school, and they're going to have a community garden with those same kids this summer so that those kids get nutritional food. So it's things like that where maybe 5 years ago we might have sat back and thought, oh, somebody else is taking care of that after-school issue with those kids, so we don't have to do anything, or maybe we can't do anything. And now we're given that space where we realize that we can be part of something and that we can make a difference, and our voices are being heard because now instead of just listening to the megaphone, we've got all of these other voices in this community.
And we can be one of them.
Yeah. And not only can you be, but we want you to be. It's welcoming, you know, and the more the merrier. And we need everyone. And the more we see that people joining in, the more we see that we need each other, the more welcoming it becomes. It's sort of like a circle. And so as that circle grows, I think hopefully we'll have the numbers that we need. And as we share our ideas, we'll create that map so that we can get to the just society that so many of us desire.
You know, Jessica, after the SOPA PIPA bills were defeated, for those of you who don't know the story, but basically these were laws that were designed to give the government or whatever controls the government the right to shut down websites if there's a copyright infringement on that site. It's very dangerous in a time when the fate of democracy is really much tied to the fate. It's very much tied to the fate of freedom of communication on these social media and new media tools. And so, on a single day, there were, you know, with some leadership by people like Jimmy Wales, who founded Wikipedia, and others who are internet leaders, there was a tremendous backlash from people who were users of the internet, and this was across the political spectrum. And on the morning of, I forget the day exactly, there were six senators who had spoken out against PIPA, the Senate version of this bill. And by the end of the day, it was, what was it, 48, Annabelle? 47?
Yeah, actually, yes.
I see the clock. What I tweeted when that happened is that it proves that the people, the 330 million of us, plus the internet is potentially more powerful than 1% media and 1% media consumers. In other words, the Fox News and the Rush Limbaugh plus the people who listen to and consume their products, watch their products. There was, you know, up until that day, it was always going to be true that what the 1% media wanted, they could just sound the alarm, start the rumor, create the framework, people would repeat it, and then the phone calls would happen, and Senate, House, they'd cave. But this time, it wasn't from the 1% media networks. It wasn't from the consumers of those shows. It was actually from people who just use what is today, well, becoming the standard form of communication. It's basically like the air we breathe, the internet. And so that's where I see the hope for all the different policies when we get into, you know, specific things like publicly funded elections. All those things become possible because of the new playing field that we're living in today.
Okay, thanks, Eric. Until next week, we're going to be back next week on Sunday at 5 o'clock. I hope you join us. And I hope Jessica and Cameron join me in saying goodbye to everyone. Bye,
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
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 Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Cameron.
You're
Bye,
welcome.
Jessica. Bye,
Bye. Take it easy. I'll send you my stuff on Facebook. Have a good day. Bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.